Interview with Lewis Brothers, October 6th, 2008, in Wicomico Church, Virginia, by Kenneth Durr. Are you a Virginia native?
Virginia native. Graduated from a local high school here in Gloucester, Virginia. And learned reading and writing and rode to Richmond. And I went up and enrolled in, I was Richmond Professional Institute before Virginia Commonwealth.
Okay.
And I also took courses at RPI. And then I went through a business college, which is now out of existence, Smithdale Massey Business College. Mm-hmm. And then the draft interrupted, and I never did finish. Mm. I ended up serving a hitch in the Coast Guard. And I'd always pursued an accounting career. And when I finished my active duty in the Coast Guard, I went back to school some more, still at RPI, and I became interested in brokerage accounting, which was something unique at the time. And I was doing some part-time work at Philip Morris Research Center, and I decided I needed to start full-time a career. And I called the Securities and Exchange Commission and asked if they had any openings for examiners. And they said, no, they didn't, but they knew of an opening at the Securities Division of the State Corporation Commission. Hmm. So I applied and went to work there. And back in those days, the states and the SEC were really very cooperative in that regulatory.
When was this about?
This would probably be 67.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, my brokerage, because one thing, you couldn't take brokerage accounting in school. You had to do it. Mm-hmm. Either go to work for a firm or either be a regulator.
Right.
And I'm glad that I made the decision that I did, because with the advent of the computers, you know, all of the need for individuals doing that stuff was gone.
Yeah.
And back in the days when Ross Perot automated the DuPont, everything was automated from there on out. But I trained with the SEC examiners out of the Washington Regional Office.
Hmm. How did you do that? Was it a program that they had?
No. Everything was just so cooperative. The Washington regional administrator, Alex Brown, used to have semi-monthly meetings with all of the regulators so we wouldn't be running into each other, you know, and at the firms. And everybody knew what everybody was doing. And they basically put me into their Virginia audit program. And I spent probably a good year and a half, going around with the examiners auditing the Virginia brokerage firm.
Okay.
And that's basically how I learned the business. And then we used to do joint investigations and what have you. And one thing led to the other. And in 71, I became director of the division. And
who were you working for? Who was director before you?
A man by the name of E.C. Frazier.
It sounds like he was very close then with the SEC regional.
He was, and well, everyone was. Merrill, the regional meetings we used to have would be with the SEC, New York Stock Exchange, NESD, Virginia, Maryland, West Virginia, and Pennsylvania, and also the District 10 of NESD. In District 11 of NASD, which were in Philadelphia, because they overlapped. And we mostly used to meet at in Washington at the SEC headquarters. Mm-hmm. And when I became director, I just basically continued, you know, the process.
Were these week-long meetings? How did they work?
Usually a day. Okay. And you just get up and present you know, what cases you were working on. And it was really strange because most of us were working together on certain cases, what have you. And it was the states and the SEC did a lot of work together, and it was basically our time to inform the SROs what we were doing.
Okay, so you were talking to the New York Stock Exchange people and the NASDAQ people.
And the SDA, yeah. Okay. And they would tell us, you know, what they were working on. And problematic firms. I guess this program started with the envision of the SEC regional administrator, Alex Brown. And we had a brokerage firm that got into financial trouble. And I don't know, I think it's long gone, but I don't think I'm going to mention names for this thing, if that's okay. Some of them I will, but I won't.
If it's long gone, we're probably safe.
But anyway, they got into financial trouble. And I remember going up as an auditor, and I got in the firm, and the SEC was there, Stock Exchange was there, the NESD was there, State of Maryland was there, and I was there. So we agreed to kind of pull out and form a group to do the audit, because we were driving.
You didn't need all those people.
No.
Yeah.
And at that point in time, Brown made the comment, this should never happen again.
Okay.
And we started, and I think we were the first group to do the cooperative program. When I became director of the division, obviously I carried, you know, the programs out, and I did, and my staff did a lot of work with the SEC, and I went back and kind of took a look at some of the investigations that we did jointly with the SEC during those days that stick out in my mind, and can go over a few of them for you. One, and I'll just leave it this way, it was a very large Baptist church in Virginia, was selling church bonds.
Okay.
And I remember the reverend of the church and the financial person came to my office, and we started looking at what they were doing, because there was a lot of advertising, and we saw some of the people, residents, complained about it. So we started looking into it.
They complained to you?
Yeah.
Okay.
And to our agency.
Right.
And we started looking at it, and I mean, one of the things we were concerned about was public offering of securities with really non-existent financial statements. No one, word of mouth, what the church was worth. And the bonds were sold on the faith and credit of the church. And I remember the preacher and his accountant coming into my office, and they had done this balance sheet showing what the net worth. And I remember looking at it, and I saw they were listing $100,000 in marketable securities. And I remember asking them what kind of securities they were, all listed on the stock exchange. And I asked them where they were physically, the certificates. And I remember the reverend said, well, they actually belong to a widow who's 93 years old and in bad health, and who is a member of the church, and she's mentioned us in her will. Well, I tried to explain to them that in accordance with general accepted accounting procedures, that could not be an asset of the church. Well, the church continued to sell using the financial statement. And finally, the SEC, Washington Regional Office, became involved. And they went in and took a look and felt that it would be appropriate to seek a temporary injunction to shut it down and probably appoint a receiver because the church was teetering on financial problems.
So they were trying to get money just to survive, I guess.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, of course, the case was heard in federal district court. And with my experience and my meeting with the reverend and the accountant. I was a witness for the SEC in the hearing. And I remember the night before the hearing, we were all in the city, and the reverend got on the on his radio program and said that he was in the grips of a battle with the devil disguised as the Virginia State Corporation Commission and the United States Securities and Exchange Commission. And the heathens were staying at the motel out on the bypass. Well, needless to say, threats and everything else. And the next morning, I remember going to court, Federal District Court, and accompanied by U.S. Marshals. And we had the hearing. And I remember I was a witness and I told my story. But, and I remember the cross-examination from a lawyer who was kind of a lay preacher out of Nashville, Tennessee. I don't remember his name, but it was dramatically, the stage was dramatically set because we from the government came in wearing our dark suits and the reverend and the attorney were dressed in white and, you know, it was a typical. Uh-huh. And the judge, of course, the courtroom was packed with the members of the church. And the judge was just having one hell of a time keeping order in the proceedings because every time when the opening statement came from the church lawyer after he finished, sat down, got a standing ovation, and of course, our opening statement, we were booed.
It was a real
But
show.
Anyway, I gave my testimony, and I remember the cross-exam was very short. The preacher asked me, and the reverend lawyer asked me if I was a member of a Baptist church. I said yes. He said the name, and I said yes, that's right, in Richmond. And he said, well, do you have certified financial statements in your church? And I said, no, but we don't sell bonds. And that was pretty much the end of the discussion. And took my testimony and a couple of other people, and then the proceedings ended for the day. And I remember the federal judge calling everybody in to his chambers, and he says, my chambers are going to be open for the evening, and I would expect some sort of a reasonable settlement by the next day. And the settlement was worked out where the SEC dropped the fraud charges and the receiver appointment and a three businessmen from the community were basically formed to oversee the affairs of the church. And the church agreed not to sell any more bonds until everything was in order and they had the necessary prospectuses with financial statements. And I remember the next morning sitting out on the bench and the SEC lawyers and the church's lawyers were in the chambers with the judge working out the final details for signatures. And the reverend told me, we were just sitting out there together, he said, Mr. Brothers, I've learned a valuable lesson in this. I said, what's that, Reverend? He said, well, he said, I don't have to sell bonds. People will give me money. And I don't have to worry about the likes of the federal and state government.
And not a good lesson to learn, I guess.
I guess not. So,
well, you something you said was is interesting there. At some point, the this was in your lap, and then the SEC decided to come in. What was it that brought the SEC in?
Complaints.
Okay.
Just like, you know, to them, just like they came to me, and you know, through our quarterly meetings. Of bi-monthly meetings, they knew about the case because I had presented it and said that we were working on it. Mm-hmm. And they decided they would not intervene until, you know, they received complaints.
Okay.
And once they received them, why, they came in and we got them up to speed real quick on it. And we were able to move fast.
Okay.
That was one of the nice things that the states did back in those days. The state always had the ability to move quicker in the court
right.
than the SEC did on the federal level. So a lot of times for subpoenaed documents, which the SEC subpoenas were contested, or any sort of temporary injunctive actions, the state, the SEC would usually come to the states and it would be done in state court.
Okay.
Because it could be effected quicker. Right. Backpedaling, our commission, the Virginia State Corporation Commission, to this day is a court of record with direct appeal to the Supreme Court of the state.
Okay.
And the three commissioners basically sit as judges. So any of the hearings by the staff of the agencies are brought directly to the commission, and their court orders are binding just like any court of record. So, I mean, the commission used our court a lot for stuff.
And so then they can go to the Court of Appeals, and you know exactly where you
stand. Well, interesting enough, from the Corporation Commission situation, the appeal was direct to the Supreme Court of the state.
Okay.
So you could literally do two appeals and be in the Supreme Court of the United States.
Jeez.
You know,
yeah,
that's
yeah,
quite
yeah.
quick.
Okay. Other big cases from those
well, I remember,
early years.
This is a side, but talking about cooperative stuff,
mm-hmm.
I remember a case that we did. It was a licensing case by discount brokers, and they were contesting the state's authority to regulate the discount broker because they were national firms,
mm-hmm.
and they were saying it was in violation of the Commerce Clause, what have you. And we were able to the case was not brought at the commission. We were sued in federal court. So the case was done in the federal district court. And we were able to prevail, or did prevail, on the Commerce Clause argument. And the federal judge concluded in his order that they should register and be regulated at the state level. And they appealed. And on the appellate level, the SEC intervened on behalf of the state.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, he's a judge now, but Stanley Sporkin,
yeah.
who was director of the division, made the argument. Of course, the court upheld the state's position. So that's another area.
Was this one of the big brokerage firms, the big national ones?
It was a bunch of them, but they were represented by a trade organization. And the trade organization were the ones that sued us.
Huh. I suppose they probably had these issues with other states, too.
Yeah.
They just chose Virginia for
some
reason? Well,
they chose Virginia for one big reason, because Virginia had a very difficult requirement, and we never liked it as a staff. But in order to be registered in the state, you had to have a place of business. And we, as a staff, thought it was an onerous provision, but it was in the state law, and we had to enforce it. And it was a great opportunity for us, this case, to get rid of that piece of legislation.
Huh.
So it was a good compromise. The federal court said the requirement by the state of the place of business interfered with the Commerce Clause, but the pure fact to register was not, and the state had a necessary reason, regulatory authority for requiring registration. And I want to say, when the SEC intervened at the state level, the only thing was up on appeal was the licensing piece, because we never appealed the place of business. So that was the...
Because you were glad to see that go.
We were glad to see it go.
Mm-hmm.
And But anyway, Judge Spolkin made the argument on behalf of the state representing the SEC. Okay. That was one of the last cases I think he did before he went over to the CIA as general counsel and then came back on the federal bench. So I'll just throw that in as a side. Another big case that we did in conjunction with the SEC was a finance company down in the Tidewater area who was selling debt. And it wasn't limited to the state of Virginia. It was interstate. It was all West Virginia, Maryland, Pennsylvania, Virginia. And they basically had a situation where each little finance office was a separate corporation. And they had about $100,000 in cash. And they staggered the year-end accounting periods of each corporation. So the $100,000 would wing from one to the other, and they would show themselves solid. And I remember spending 6 months with members of the staff, SEC people, in these people's office doing this audit. And finally, the SEC moved in federal district court to have a receiver appointed and to shut down the sale of the securities, and they were obviously successful. But that was a case that we did together.
How'd you figure out that they had $100,000 floating around the place?
It was a little bit of... Well, once we got into the books, we were able to trace the interest. But it was a little teeny bit of luck and a little bit of accounting experience on my part, because we went in first, and I remember the controller of the company showing us this outline. I asked him to give us an organizational outline, and this thing stretched over 17 corporations. And I went to the top of them and told him I'd like to see the financial statement of this one. And it so happened that on the date they took that off, the $100,000 was somewhere else. And they went solved.
Okay.
So that kind of started the process.
Yeah. But odds were good you were going to pick one of the ones without the $100,000.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
Exactly.
Huh.
And we didn't know that it was only $100,000 at that time, but we knew that the holding company was broke, so you naturally assumed the rest of them were. It took us about 6 months of tracing book entries and cash, and you can imagine a finance office, you know, daily, but we were able to do it, and were able to shut it down before it exposed, you know, before it lost more money from people. And let me see. Another area that, and this is kind of a NASA thing, but the states multiply were able to act with the assistance of the SEC. The SEC had a procedure for oil and gas, small oil and gas wells, and in those days it was called Schedule D. As you know, Reg D has replaced that, but that's a totally different situation. And this was more of a form. You fill out a form and you noted that you had a number of investors and you filed it with the SEC. And none of it was filed on the state level. And most of the deals were done out of the oil and gas states, Texas, Oklahoma, in that area. And a bunch of, I guess, thieves and charlatans got into the process and were selling interest in these things all over the country. And I remember going to the corporate finance people at the SEC, and they were reluctant to share records. And we ended up going to Judge Spokane, and Irv Pollock was one of the commissioners in those days and saw no problem with it at all, turned over the information. The state of Texas, who had one of the few computers at the state level in those days, basically inputted the data, manipulated it, and set out all of the filings that affected residents of every state. And the states bought collective actions against the entities and the companies, and then the SEC proceeded to and basically shut the whole thing down.
Hmm. Now, why would Corp Fin tell you they didn't want you to see those?
I don't know.
Just turf, I guess.
Turf. But that was kind of a bad experience with Corp Fin, but I can tell you a good one. Reg D, today as we know it, was basically put together by the SEC staff and state regulators. The whole rule was designed. And I remember Mickey Beach was the Corp Fin head. Mm-hmm. And the SEC did projects like that where they knew it was going to affect states. They would put the state regulators right into the implementation before it was ever published for comment. And we worked on Reg D and basically drew the rule. And then it was published and adopted by the SEC, and it is what it is today.
So did you meet in Washington a lot, stuff like that?
We had a group of state people. I was one of them. We were sponsored by NASA. And we probably met it was an ongoing process for a good 6 months before it was ever published. So we started out with a bare bones program and then, you know, developed it and added meat to it. And Corp Fin people would draft and we'd review it and come back and give and take. And the states gave up some things. The SEC gave up some things. And it was a good compromise. And that was the way that rule was adopted.
The oil and gas leasing sort of falls in the same category, at least to me, as the penny stock boom that you saw.
Well, it started out as a legitimate industry. I'm not sure what penny stockbrokers ever were, but anyway, this was a legitimate industry. Okay. There was a small bunch of wildcatters who were drilling wells and going to close group of knit people that understood the oil and gas business to put up the money for the drilling. And then it totally got out of hand where the people that were organizing the thing would, you know, be soliciting people all over the United States. No experience, you know, anything. Mm-hmm. Just totally got out of hand.
Did you see your share of those mining stocks and earthworms and things like that back
we
in
saw
the 70s?
Mining stocks, earthworms, orange groves, anything that could be syndicated. I'll tell you a criminal case we did. This was us alone on a worm farm. We had a traveling con artist from out of state come through and sell a young couple are interested in a worm farm out in the western part of our state. And I remember they put their life savings in it. And then, obviously, no contact, just blew up. And they complained to us, and we went into it. And we were able to get the Commonwealth attorney to indict criminally the individual. And, of course, he had long gone.
Right.
But the nice thing about a criminal indictment is it stays on your record. And it stayed as an outstanding warrant. And a couple of years later, the guy was picked up on a speeding ticket in Ohio. And when they ran it, they found him. And we extradited him back to Virginia. And I remember he sat in the local jail all summer await trial. And the state's deal then was anybody who was in jail worked on the road gang. So he spent the summer out on the road gang with the guy standing over him with a 12-gauge and fighting the copperhead snakes and the chiggers and the heat. And mysteriously enough, by the next fall, when he came to trial, the money became available.
So he made restitution.
Made restitution, and Commos turned into a process case, but that was kind of a worm for him. We did a lot of criminal cases in addition to our regular story stuff. I was in Virginia. I had a great staff, and I'll tell you about them later, but we were heavily involved in the registration issues that came through, the public issues, but we were also heavily involved in the registration of brokers, financial planners, investment advisor representatives, brokers, agents.
Right.
And
Financial planners actually came in at some point in there, didn't they?
Well,
wasn't that an initiative?
We were the first state to... NASA put up a model program.
Okay.
Model Act. And we were the first state to adopt it.
Okay.
Over the objections of the industry, heavily. Yeah. And we were able to prevail, you know, at the state level, in the legislature. And it was adopted. And I set up a program with the NESD to automate the registration of firms and investment advisors, because the bulk of the registered process were the existing brokerage firms, because by that time all of the firms were managing money and the brokers were operating as agents selling stock, and then they were financial planners and what have you, and we required them to register as investment advisor representatives. It was a very smooth transition. Put the exam up, and the legitimate industry came right in and registered. We always had those that hung out there. You know, one particular one that is memorable to me was we had a financial planner. He was a Finnish national who came into the Richmond area and claimed he had some sort of esoteric option strategy and managed a lot of people's money in the strategy. He's basically using it for his own good, did very little of it. And we were able to criminally indict him, and he skipped and went back to Finland. And I guess he would have been fine if he'd stayed there. But about a year or so later, he came back into Canada and started calling some of the Virginia investors. And they immediately complained to us, and we were able to have the Royal Canadian Mounties pick him up. We extradited him back to Virginia, criminally tried him, and the results was 222 years in prison.
Whew.
The guy, and in those times, we had a great criminal prosecutor in Richmond who basically had jurisdiction over most of our cases and was basically, his education was in white-collar crime, and that particular office, the Richmond Commonwealth Attorney's Office, did white-collar crime cases, which was somewhat unique.
Hmm.
Anyway, he was the guy that tried him and did a number of our criminal cases. And as I said, he got the time, and he was in jail about 5 years, and he worked his way out to a trustee position and got to use a telephone and opened an account with a brokerage firm and started trading options again. And this time it was with his cellmate's money.
Oh, jeez.
And the warden called me and said, you know, this guy will come up for parole in another 5 years or so, and I'd like to make sure he doesn't get out. So we did the case, criminally prosecuted him again, tacked on another 10 years. And I don't know what happened to the guy. Jeez. As I know, he's still in jail.
He just couldn't help himself.
Yeah. Registration-wise, these were the public registration programs. Mm-hmm. We had all of the syndications. Back in those days when everything was syndicated.
Explain that concept a little bit.
Limited partnership.
Okay.
Would be formed to a lot of more real estate, oil and gas, movies, okay. Bringing investors.
I know real estate limited partnerships were a problem.
Big time. And in connection with that, one of the last few cases I did at the commission through NASA, we formed a task force, and in partnership with the SEC, investigated and shut down one of the major brokerage firms from selling the partnership units. We were able to have a, in a settlement negotiation, mm-hmm. we were able to have a trustee appointed, which turned out to be Irv Pollack, former SEC commissioner. Mm-hmm. And something in the neighborhood of $1.8 billion was returned to the investors.
This was a big brokerage.
Big one.
Yeah.
They also paid a fine of $500,000 to every state.
This was a brokerage that was using unlicensed brokers?
No. It was all licensed.
Okay.
All of the securities were registered.
Right.
It was totally, everything, the registration process was all compliant. Just the partnerships were basically done. Some of them had no chance of any economic gain.
Gotcha.
That was misrepresentation in connection with the sale. You know, there were unqualified investors that were put into the programs. And it was just a major mass illegal selling element.
Mm-hmm. Now, does this shade into tax shelters at some point?
They were all tax shelters.
Okay.
And that was one of the unique things about the shelters. I mean, it was before the IRS broke up the tax shelter business, there were tons of money that were written off through those deals because a lot of them failed. But mixed into that, they were all sold not as tax shelters, but as economical, viable enterprises that would make money.
Mm-hmm.
So I won't bore you with the details of the program, but there was a book written about it. It was called Serpent on the Rock. Hmm. And it was written by New York Times business writer Kirk Eichenwald.
Okay.
And you'll see the states and the SEC play a very prominent role in it.
Hmm. Excellent.
And as a matter of fact, we'll take a break. Let me
sure.
get some water.
Let me get started here. Okay.
Okay, a couple of cases that we did when I was in Virginia that I felt, I mean, just to give example, obviously, I was there 24 years. I mean, these are not the only ones, but yeah, these are the ones that come to mind. We had a stockbroker for one of the large major firms, worked for one firm for a while and then moved to another one and was basically stealing money from customers and doing things like manufacturing account statements to show that they were in good shape when in fact he was using their money. And the way he would do it by hand-delivering checks. He would tell the brokerage firm that the customer Z had called in and wanted a check for funds in his account and to go ahead and cut it, and he would hand-deliver it. And he would take the check and forge it and convert it. And this went on for a period of a long time with one brokerage firm, and then he moved to another one and continued at that one. And finally, as those things always happen, you can't keep balancing the plates but right, so much, and a customer complained. And we started into it, and it was quite a big case. It was in the press for a good period of time. I remember one of the local folk artists, probably at VCU at the time, wrote a ballad attributed to this guy's ill fated deeds, and it turned out it was played on some of the radio stations, what have you. But anyway, we went into the case, and first of all, we made sure that both firms stepped up to the plate and refunded all the money to the customers.
Did you? You went after the. You had to go after the firms. Right?
We started after the firms.
Yeah.
The first thing we wanted to do was make sure the customers were made whole.
Right.
And we got, and to the brokerage firm's credit, there was no resistance. I mean, they stepped up and did the right thing. They paid the customers off. Mm-hmm. We criminally prosecuted the broker and got him 20 years for doing it. And then we started a failed to supervise case against both firms because it was pretty non-existent supervision over this individual. And the fraud that he was doing on the conversion of funds should have been detected a long time. And one of the particular firms, the cage wasn't secure. He was going in the cage and getting copies of monthly statements so he could manufacture false ones. Mm. So the firm, both of them settled out. And we ended up doing, we were, I think, one of the first states that did this. We didn't find the firm. And we didn't take action against either one of the branch managers. The SEC took action against one of them. But we entered into agreement with both of the firms, which required them to hire at the state's choosing an independent accounting firm. And we did the RFP and went out and hired the firm. And the firms got the chance to pay for it. And the deal was on for 2 years, on a six-month basis, they had to come in, the firms, and audit with their own internal auditors every branch office in the state. And then our auditor, which they were paying for, would go behind and do peer review.
Okay.
And that took place for a period of 2 years. And we had a number of other firms located in, some of them were in Virginia, but most of them were around the Richmond area at that time, which allowed the process of hand delivery of checks. And because the obvious thing, the legitimate broker would go deliver the check, go over the customer's account, and probably end up doing more business. But for the charlatans or the thieves, the money was too tempting and they would take it. And we did a number of firms that way, putting the independent auditors in. And finally, they cut the process out.
Yeah, you found some more of that then.
We found more of it. And finally, the firms on their own stepped up and cut it out.
Mm. Now, was this the kind of thing that you would go to the other states and you'd say, you know, this worked out really well for us, why don't you take a look at hand delivery?
Exactly. We'd share the information with us. The information would be shared with from the other states with us. I certainly don't want to give any impression that I was the author or instigator of requiring the internal audit. Well, that was something I picked up from the SEC. Mm-hmm. They used to do it. Mm-hmm. But I think it was one of the earlier cases at the state level that it was done. And as you can imagine, the firms objected to it strenuously.
Yeah.
But they had no choice.
It's better than the alternative, I guess.
Exactly right.
One thing we didn't talk about is mergers and acquisitions and the regulation of those. Did you see a good bit of that in the late 70s and the early 80s?
We did. Virginia had one of the, and I think what you're talking about is more acquisitions. You're talking about the takeovers.
Yes, indeed. That's
Virginia was one of the states that had the early takeover statutes. And I remember a number of cases. I remember talking, sitting down and having some discussions with Judge Sporkin or Stanley when he was at the enforcement level of the SEC. Mm-hmm. And it was definitely a federal securities matter. It was publicly trading of securities, and it was something that, in my personal opinion, the states should not have been involved in. Mm-hmm. Except in the earlier days, you had what they referred to as Saturday night specials, St. Valentine's Day massacres, where you'd have a board meeting and a raider would show up at the board and announce that he owned a substantial portion of your stock, and that they basically wanted to effect a buyout. And I think the purpose of the state laws during that time served well, because the target company would run to the state. The state would start proceeding. Mm-hmm. And it would be announced, and time would be bought for the target company to decide if they wanted to. The deal was a good deal. If they wanted to fight it, whatever they wanted to do. And in the early days of it, there were no 13D requirements under the Federal Act where you had to disclose once you got above 10% of the stock.
Right.
And I remember having some discussions with Judge Stanley in the early days, and he was saying, well, you know, the states really shouldn't be involved in this. And I was saying, well, they should be up until there's a public announcement. And I remember giving him an example of we had a public company up in the western part of the state, and it was a local factory in the area, and everybody owned stock in it. But it was a stock exchange traded company. Mm-hmm. Very good company. And a farmer came home. I remember taking his statement, to me. He was came home from lunch one day, and there was Archbishop Jewell on the phone arguing of offering him $20 a share more than the price of his stock. Mm. And he sold the stock to come home that night and learn on the news that a tender offer had been made for the company for 40. Mm. And I remember, you know, doing that, talking, having that discussion with Stanley. And he said, well, you know, to a certain effect, I do agree with you. Something needs to be done to expose these things. And the SEC embarked on a period of 13D requirements. And the Virginia law would be changed because the state tender offer had been, the statute would be tweaked every year just enough to get it out of the preemptive issues. Because I'm digressing here, but going back, the states were eventually preempted in the federal court
right.
from, you know, administering those laws.
Right.
Well, after the state, the 13Ds and everything came out, we were not too concerned about the issue, but the law was there and we had to enforce it. And if we got a complaint from a company, we would go before the commission and ask for a public hearing. Well, the company would put up a big battle and a big fight and try to poke holes in the disclosure document. And eventually, the state would get jerked into the federal district court by the raider. And we were never enjoined but once. But I remember we would always agree in an informal agreement not to impose the provisions of the state tender offer law. And the federal district judge would say, I remember he would say, good to see you here again, Mr. Brothers. I would always testify. Virginia legislature keeps tweaking the statute and changes it, and I keep striking it down. And we'll see you back with the next one.
Yeah.
So that was kind of my experience with the tender offer stuff.
Okay. Yeah, it was a tricky situation because the SEC was, you know, very often sort of in going along with the corporate raiders in wanting to give stockholders the opportunity to
Well, I didn't really have any problem with that philosophy myself because as long as it was disclosed, as long as it was announced, and the shareholders were given an opportunity
right.
for the profit. And you got to realize a lot of these companies were targets because you had lax management.
Right.
And the company was worth, you know, basically on the books a hell of a lot more than the stock was traded for.
Right.
And the management of the company wasn't doing anything with it. So in that case, the statutes did serve, you know, I think a legitimate reason. In the early days, when it first started, I think the SEC was behind the curve and the states were out front.
Yeah.
And once it got to the point it was fully disclosed, customers were given an option. They'd have to sell the stock. And everything was disclosed about it. I mean, it seemed like to me that was the appropriate place for it to be.
Okay.
It's just my opinion.
Uh-huh. Well, let's back up a little bit. In talking with other state regulators, there's the discussion of there's merit states, and then there's New York, and then there's everybody else.
Yeah.
And would Virginia qualify as a merit state?
Virginia was almost merit and mostly disclosure.
Okay.
The merit states were more located in the Midwest.
Right.
And they were very good for coming up with model guidelines to review the programs. Those particular states, commissioner literally had the authority to look at a deal and determine whether it was fair, just, and equitable. Now, then you had other states where it was disclosure. And then you had Virginia and a bunch of them that were in the middle that we didn't have the authority to basically, well, I certainly didn't as a director, to declare that something was fair, just, and equitable.
Right.
But if we had guidelines that were published and adopted and the program didn't meet those guidelines, then we could deny it.
Okay.
And we published a lot of the guidelines on oil and gas, real estate, syndication. Just thinking they were there. The biggest ones, a lot of the syndication products.
Mm-hmm.
And most all of those guidelines were developed by the Midwest Securities Commission.
Okay.
So we used to go to their meetings, you know, to learn what the problems were, to review the guidelines, to participate in them. And so we were kind of in the middle.
Yeah, it sounds like you could do much the same thing, but you were deciding in general terms rather than on a case-by-case
basis.
Yeah,
our statute was such that the guidelines had to be published,
mm-hmm.
and the company that was making the filing deal was not in accordance with the guidelines for us to deny it. We just couldn't look at it and say, we don't think it's good. So,
right.
Get out. And, I mean, I don't think the Midwest commissioners or the total fair, just, and equitable states were that arbitrary or capricious. I mean, they had their own standard of reviews.
Right.
That were in their states, but they just didn't, a lot of it wasn't published.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the Midwest commissioners had their own association. Had NASA, which in those days had very little money. And the Midwest obviously didn't either. And eventually NASA implemented the uniform exam and became had enough money in its treasury to fund the different programs.
Right.
And at that point in time, the Midwest commissioners decided it would be more appropriate to, you know, they were members of NASA too,
right.
but to dissolve the Midwest Association and do all that work through NASA.
Right. Well, let's walk through that a little bit. You became involved with NASA sometime in the early 70s?
Yeah.
As treasurer, is that right?
I started out as treasurer of NASA in the early 70s, and went through the progression of the offices in the association and served as president in 1976. That was the first term.
Okay.
And this was, with my presidency, the first start of the uniform registration programs and the infancy of the CRD.
Where did the impetus for that? Let's start with the registration, the uniform
registrar. Oh, the central registration depository.
Right. That's the second thing. I'm thinking of the uniform securities exam as being an important initiative?
Well, that started, that was...
Is that a little later?
That was later.
Okay.
The first uniform initiative was done in 1976.
Okay.
And it was the standardization of all the forms.
Okay.
I basically, because NASA didn't have any treasury, but I appointed Hugh Makins to basically lead that project for the states. And NASA financed some of his trips, obviously, to Washington. And Hugh was quite a statesman and obviously good lawyer and good securities commissioner. Mm-hmm. And he probably never say he was, but he was a good politician in that he could arrange agreements mm-hmm. with people.
And I suppose everybody thought that their forms were the best.
Or, yes, yeah. And everybody had one. All 50 states, the SEC, Stock Exchange, NASD. He was able to, in a year's time, was basically able, with the help of the other regulators in meetings, to come up with a standardized U4, U5, and Form BD. The states, for instance, gave up a lot of requirements to make the form uniform, mm-hmm. Like individual license. Most states require you to have a license, like a driver's permit, pictures of applicants, references, staggered renewal dates. I mean, you know, just to name a bunch. Once the forms were put together, shortly thereafter, NASA developed the state uniform exam. That was kind of the second problem because so many states had different exams. And I remember, for instance, in Virginia, we used to proctor exams for other states. If a broker wanted to be registered in Texas, Texas would send us the exam, hard copy. We would bring the person in the conference room. They would take it, and we'd monitor the process, and then we'd send it back to Texas, and they'd grade it, tell the person whether they passed or failed. And you can imagine the time that took, you know, to get into the industry. Well, the states decided to move forward and put together a uniform exam, which would basically work in tandem with the Series 7. And it was adopted by the states. The states did a contract. I'm going to let it go.
Okay. In tandem with Series 7?
Well, the Stock Exchange NASD equivalent was Series 7.
Okay.
We didn't require it, but the state exam had a lot of some of the information that was on the 7, plus an exam on the state law.
Okay.
I will eventually quit. You might want to stop. Go ahead.
Okay.
We were talking about the uniform exam.
Right.
The states entered into a contract with the NASD to administer it. Mm-hmm. Because at that time, the NASD had all the proctor offices located all over the country. And they had the Series 7, and they also administered exams for the Stock Exchange. And through that program, they were all online, and applicants could come into the offices, take the exam. It would be automatically graded by the computer, and they could know before they left if they passed or failed.
Okay.
So the states entered into a contract with NASA, I mean with the NASD, to administer that exam. States owned the exam, owned the question bank, and at that time, of course, the thing that was unique about it, it was hard to compromise the exam because it was a bank of questions, and the computer would make the selection, and each test was kind of individual. Before, you had the individual hard copies, and they'd long since been compromised by the testing, the agencies that taught the test.
Right.
And I mean, they'd simply, you know, have people prepping for the exam and go in and come out and say, can you remember three questions? And after a period of time, they'd had them all. So that that state exam, I mean, I think the pass rate on it before the Series 63 in those days was very high. And the 63 was not implemented with the idea of gotcha for the industry. I mean, we wanted an exam that basically 75 to 80% of the people passed. And we, if the questions went above that percentile, we reworked them. If it went below, we reworked them. And we found the computer would tell us which questions were missed and which were answered. So that was the way that NASA continued to review it. The NASD, of course, had no part in it.
And of course, to administer.
That was the start of the funding for the association, because there was an exam fee paid. And we paid the NASD an administration fee, but the bulk of the funds went to the states.
This sounds like a lot of work putting together these questions and monitoring them. And was this a committee that did this?
A NASA committee did it. And it, interesting enough, most of the state regulators in the NASA projects would always meet on the weekend because they had the jobs to do.
Yeah.
And so most of the work was done on weekends. I was not involved in the original group, and I must say I can't remember who they were that put the original exam together, but I got to tell you, they spent hours of doing that. I remember after the exam program was up for a period of years, I was on the committee for a year redoing the questions, and it's a thankless job. Somebody has to do it. But after the exam and after the forms, it was just a matter of time before the system. And the NASD, interesting enough, the states initiated that process. And there were, I remember the commissioner from Massachusetts was involved, commissioner from Arkansas, one of the staff members from Arkansas, commissioner from Minnesota, to name a few. I can name those people. Commissioner from Arkansas was Harvey Bell. His staff person that contributed so much to it was Nancy Jones. Mary Alice Brophy was commissioner from Minnesota. Ray Cochi was the commissioner from Massachusetts. But I remember those people meeting as a committee, and there are others that I'm sure I've left out, possibly Tom Krebs from Alabama. And they spent countless hours meeting with the NASD, working toward the program.
Let's just jump in there. So we were talking about the CRD and the origins of that.
The origin, and well, as I said, right after the forms were done, Hugh Makins and I talked a lot about the idea of the forms, and we felt that that was a first process. I know the commissioner from Arkansas was one of the innovators, one of the thinkers about it. And certainly the commissioner from Massachusetts, Cochi, and the commissioner from Alabama, Krebs. And, you know, it was kind of a collective thing that we all started talking about at meetings and felt that, you know, this could be done. And, of course, NASA, by that time, had the funding, so he was able to take on this kind of a project. But I think those people, and like I said, I was around at the inception, involved in a lot of the discussions. But I think those individuals, and certainly some more that I've forgotten, were ones that were the predominant ones that came up with the thoughts and the ideas about it. I know after the project was put together where we saw it could work, not me, but a group of the... we knew it could be done in one or two places. It had to be done at the NESD or the socket chain because they had the technology to do it. And a group of the NASA board or the state administrators presented the program to the stock exchange and they turned it down. And the NESD was more than willing and ready to participate in it, so we went to the NESD with it, and they basically put the technology together. And I remember NASA entered into a contract with the NESD. Mm-hmm. And as part of the contract, it required the NESD to supply a terminal to every state. And in some states, this was the initial piece of hardware, computer equipment that they had.
This is 87 or something like that?
No. In late 79.
Late 79.
Late 70s.
Okay.
Late 70s.
Okay.
The NESD, CRD started the process in 80.
Okay.
And by 84, all of the states and the District of Columbia were on the system. The NESD, in accordance with the contract, and by the way, the commissioner from Massachusetts, Cochee, left the state and went to work for the NESD as our state liaison. At that time, they thought they needed to have one. Now, on the individual brokers, the states and the NESD and the stock exchange pretty much provided the input to the system for the brokers. The firms, the SEC was included, you know, in the process. Mm-hmm. And they were pretty much included all the way throughout, but they really, their emphasis was on the firms. Interesting enough, for years after the states adopted the forms and the registration process of the CRD, the U4, the New York Stock Exchange required their applicants to file a separate U4 with them.
Hmm.
And the form was put on the system, on the CRD system. But finally, after a number of years, I think they got a lot of pressure from the industry that they finally went totally on the system.
They just had to have that extra little bit of leverage.
I remember you fools, we, as state agencies, kept the forms. And we had a bunch of them that had New York Stock Exchange stamped on them. So the brokers would call to get a form. You know, if they were stock exchange members, we'd give them one with the stock exchange stamped on. This is for the brokers. But anyway, they sometimes old procedures die hard, I guess. But let's see.
So it sounds like you had pretty good relationships with the NASD at this point.
Oh, yeah.
You even have somebody in there who was...
Very close.
Okay.
And the NASD sent Cochee and a team of people around to set up the hardware to help each state, which they had to do, transition their database into the system. Mm-hmm. Because it wouldn't work unless you had all of the databases. And of course, there was a period of time that the NESD and the state individual systems had to run parallel. But in 1980, it all shifted over.
Okay. Seeing as how this was computerized, it probably made more sense to work with the NASD on this than the New York Stock Exchange.
It probably did. Yeah. It probably did, but I don't know. I think maybe the Stock Exchange through the years may have wished they had done it. But who knows?
They were always a little behind the curve on when it came to the technology.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly right. I'll give you an interesting piece of statistic. The registration of brokers in states increased markedly with the implementation of the CRD. I know in Virginia, has jumped from about 3,000 to 10,000 inside of 6 months. That probably indicated there were a lot of unregistered brokers in the states out and around, mm-hmm. but the states had no way of finding it. And the firms really didn't keep track of it because they didn't have to. Once the system came in, the industry really stepped up and started registering people. And needless to say, the exams had to be taken, the state exam. And that increased the asset treasury a lot. And it cut down a lot of duplication at the state level. You can imagine trying to manually renew agents every year. I mean, it was a process where we shut our entire office down. Mm. To do it in a week and through the weekend. And, obviously the CRD system did it in 2 days or a day. And I think that was probably, in my opinion, the most uniform thing the states have ever done in automating a process. Mm-hmm. And setting up something that is easy for the industry to meet the state requirements. And I'm not so sure that if the states had not have done that, that there'd probably been preemption in the Congress years ago, mm-hmm. because of the aggravation mm-hmm. of it. And the states probably would not be licensing brokers other than the ones located in their state to this day. Hmm. I mean, they certainly had the authority to do it. My discount broker case proved that.
Right.
But it was just such a burden on the industry to do that. And but I think that's one of the things that the state should take pride in,
yeah.
that they were able to do that.
Which gets to the issue of the reason for this. I mean, obviously it was a pretty high priority thing.
It was.
Yeah.
It was.
Okay.
And, NASA devoted money to it. It devoted people, members. To this day, there's a CRD committee in NASA, and it still functions. Mm-hmm. And it has a major role in what the states do. So that was that was a major thing. You have any further questions?
I'm interested in the process of moving through the 80s and you were president of NASA in 75 or 76 the first time.
Right.
And you're looking at a group that's fairly small, not a lot of budget.
Exactly.
How was NASA changing in the years after the CRD goes in? Was this Was it almost too much growth to sort of keep it, get your hands around?
No,
what was it?
One of the things that it could do was the states really stepped up with uniform regulation once they obtained the money through the processes, through the exam process, because there were state enforcement actions done uniformly. The action that I told you about with the brokerage firm, that was all funded by NASA.
Okay.
Training started at the state level, which NASA sponsored. Broker-dealer examiners were trained. Lawyers were trained. Enforcement personnel were trained. The registration modules for the products that we spoke about before, that was all funded by NASA.
And is NASA starting to bring on staff at this point?
NASA, like that? At that point in time, yeah, started to bring on staff in the Kansas office.
Mm-hmm.
And it was done by the Burdettes.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of that was in Jeff Bartel's interview with you.
Right.
So I won't go into that.
Fine.
And then NASA, of course, eventually moved to Washington. And they have a large complement of staff there to this day.
Right. How long was the move to Washington something that was anticipated for quite a long time? Or was there controversy over it?
No, I think the states always felt that the program would be eventually moved to Washington, because so many of the counter associations were there. The SIA,
right.
The Attorney General's, and, excuse me a minute.
Mm-hmm.
We stop.
Yeah.
So. All right.
All right. Okay.
Well, we were talking about the state association.
Right.
I think the commissioners always thought that it would move to Washington D.C., but the Bruce and Linda Burdett did such a super job, mm-hmm. for the organization they just spent, I don't know how many hours a day, and they had several staff members. But how they did it, I don't know. But they were always there to take the calls, and they really, really catered to the members. And fortunate for us, Bruce's background was in accounting.
Right.
So he was a very able person to handle the funds, set up the bookkeeping systems, and set up the audit processes that to this day still, exist, mm-hmm. in the association. And, that could have been a situation where the funds could have been mismanaged, and it could have really been a black eye to state regulation. But it wasn't going to happen on Bruce's watch. It never has happened, but...
But he set up the foundations,
yes,
for what was later taken to Washington.
He was responsible for it. And for whatever, when he went to Washington, I remember the first executive director was an ex-member of Congress. Can't remember his name. But I think NASA has, down through the years... played a big role on Capitol Hill, and it has a very large contingent of staff that devote time, to legislation, and the states, the state commissioners testify on the Hill a whole lot. But I don't think somebody with the profile of an ex-congressman or what have you is really needed for the association.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that type of association. I mean, it really doesn't lobby, can't lobby because of its charter. I mean, it testifies when asked,
mm-hmm.
and it obviously doesn't do PAC money can't or anything like that. So I think the down through the years, the right type of staff, you know, has been put in place.
Right. They got somebody else a few years after that, I guess.
They did. Mm-hmm. They've had a number of different people that have gone through there. And some of them have been ex-members, you know, of the states. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them have been people from, you know, outside. That's there now has a consumer background with an agency, a banking mm-hmm. group, and does an excellent job for them.
Well, let's sort of wrap up with NASA a little bit. And you have the very unusual experience of having been there relatively early before all of these really large changes
right.
you talked about. And then you went back in 91, I guess?
Sorry, right? 92.
92. What was it that brought you back to for a second stint?
A number of the members came to me and asked me if I would consider running again for president. I was further along in my career at the state level. And quite frankly, one of the reasons I knew the first time I did it, it didn't need a lot of my time because it had no money. It had one conference a year. And we had the one project, as I told you, with Hugh Makins and the U4. And other than a couple of speeches, that was about it. In 92, I knew, because I had been involved with the association, being on its board, section chair, that it was going to consume all of my time. Mm. And fortunately for me, I had a great staff in Virginia that I had no problems with leaving the agency to, and I knew it would be done right. And I'd like to name them if I could.
Sure.
My deputy was Bob Lewis. The broker-dealer section chair was run by Ron Thomas, who happens to be the director of the agency today. Max Zeckler was my enforcement chief. The registrations program was done by Irene Hay and Don Golden. And Steve Gouldsby, of course, was the registration manager for the offerings of the deals. And, of course, I had a great administration person who used to handle my funding and my budgets and everything, Hilda Butler. So I was just able to, and then also because the agency moved so smooth, I was a little bored. And the time was right to do it again. And I went on and stood for election and won it. And it was a marked difference the second time around because there were quarterly board meetings. There were so many projects. NASA had the office in Washington in those days, and I remember the executive director was a fellow by the name of Lee Polson, who was the general counsel for the Texas Securities Board and a super executive director for NASA. And he came to me right after I was elected and told me that he wanted to move back, his family wanted to move back to Texas before his first child started school. Mm-hmm. And I asked him, would there be any way that he would consider giving me until the end of the summer, which my term lasted, I believe, from September to the following September. And he said, okay, I'll stay. And he stayed on, which was certainly a big relief to me, and ran the organization until September, until about the 1st of August. Mm-hmm. And interesting enough, I did the executive director piece until we could find another one, which was in October of the following year. So I spent my time, Bob Lewis and I would get together, meet by telephone, because I was traveling, and try to set up a schedule when people would appeal staff decisions to the director. And I would make sure I would be there to listen to the presentation. And also the weekends with Bob and the other members of the staff catching up and and doing things. So, but I'll tell you, the office never missed a beat.
Yeah.
We never had a problem. The enforcement programs were just as strong. And it was just basically a credit to these people. But I think that's the difference, you know, between the two programs. I mean, there was just, I mean, the business of NASA was so big. Mm-hmm. It was congressional testimony. If I had wanted to, NASA was basically on the map, certainly before 92, but in 92, if I had wanted to, I could have done a speech to an organization every week.
Yeah.
There were so many people asking, and there were so many meetings at the president level with the SEC commissioner,
mm-hmm.
with the chairman of the stock exchange, with the president of NESD.
Were there any subjects that were really big at that point? I mean, were there things that were happening externally that was causing NASA to focus?
Well, NASA was beginning to focus on the syndications and the partnership, you know, investigations. And I recall the year after I remember I funded a lot of projects in the enforcement sections, which were looking at, you know, the syndication, mm-hmm. the regulated syndication mm-hmm. issues. There were a lot of those that were just starting up, and NASA, you know, was getting heavily involved, you know, in that stuff. The CRD contracts, the regulation of investment advisors, was really just starting, you know, to move at that time. NASA had put together a uniform investment advisor statute along with an exam for any states that wanted to get into the program. Virginia was the first one. We passed the model legislation, and I set up a regulatory registration program with the NESD just for Virginia to run the registration process, which kind of was a little side of CRD. Mm-hmm. And I had a contract that ran with the NESD up until the mid-90s when the states put on board the investment advisor registration through the what they call the IRD. And all the states came in.
Right.
And but all of that was just starting up. a lot of criminal prosecution of investment advisors stealing money by the different states. And we had our own that I told you about in mm-hmm. Virginia. I noticed when I got in that the focus I felt of cooperation between the states and the SEC had started to divide.
Mm.
There weren't any, I mean, the project that Mickey Beach did with rank D would, at that point in time, would never have been done, and still is not, with the SEC. Because the SEC does their own rules and publishes them, and the states comment. But the working projects were not done. It's true, a lot of the task force, you know, were done with the regulated industry and the brokers. But the SEC, they just weren't done as close. Mm-hmm. The SEC is there, but information is not shared as much anymore.
What did you think the reason was behind that? What had changed over those?
Probably the SEC chairman, years? Yeah. Chairmen who a lot of them did, but some of which just didn't want to cooperate with the states, didn't like the state regulatory approach. It's moved away. Mm. I spent the best portion of my presidency in 92 trying to keep, and I think I was successful, in the chairman of the SEC not poking, you know, at the state regulation.
Hmm.
And we were pretty much able to do it through kind of discussions. And before it was over, we actually agreed to speak at a conference. So I spent a lot of time trying to keep that situation from erupting into war on the press.
Yeah. Well, eventually you had the situation change with NISMIA, right?
Exactly.
And
well, you got to remember that came in 95.
Right.
So that was right after my term in 92.
Right.
But a lot of that was going on. You know, a lot of those processes were.
And okay.
Obviously, the states were trying to do what they could to maintain their turf, and they were, of course, not successful
right
in 95. I still think to this day, if we didn't have the CRD and the regulatory program we had for the licensing process, that might have gone with NISMIA.
Yeah.
But there wasn't anything to argue against. It was an easy process to do. You didn't have 50 different opinions.
Right.
The states were very aggressive and always have been and continue to be to this day in taking out brokers that they don't feel should be licensing.
Right.
Licensed. And who in the industry can argue against, you know, problem brokers?
Were you still with the Virginia in 95?
No.
Oh.
I left and went to Payne Webber in 94.
Okay. And did you stay in Virginia at that point, or where did you work for Payne Webber?
I've always worked in Virginia.
Okay. What was your role there?
Well, I'm going to get to this point. And
okay.
I was basically hired to be by Ted Levine, who was the general counsel,
mm-hmm,
to be the director of state regulatory policy.
Okay.
For Payne Webber. And
Ted Levine, the former SEC guy, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I was attached to the legal department. Ted came in to implement a new legal structure in Payne Webber, and he wanted me to be a state piece in it.
Okay.
And that's what I've done ever since.
Huh. Well, is there anything else that we haven't touched on that we should cover?
Well, let me hit all my notes again.
Yep.
The first year was up.
Hang on. Okay.
Okay, the first year was up.
And the CRD.
The CRD in 80. there were problems. The NASD didn't have enough equipment. And registrations weren't getting processed. Firms were complaining. States were complaining. One state, Tennessee, withdrew from the system. The NASD called a meeting in D.C., brought all of the commissioners in, and agreed to... The problem wasn't with the software. It was just the hardware. They didn't have enough to process the applications. And they agreed to spend multiple $1 million to buy hardware. And they implemented it. And what the states were concerned about, we were coming up on the renewal for the first year. And if the system wasn't working, it was going to be a disaster. And there were a lot of threats to pull out. And the NASD stepped up, bought the equipment, and it was set up, and the program smoothed out 30 days. The renewal took place, and no one ever looked back.
And that's the extent of the technical problems that you had with that.
Exactly right.
All right. So what year did you go to from Virginia to Payne Webber?
1994.
Okay. So you came back and watched your staff in Richmond do a little more work without you and then headed out.
Well, it's not the same staff.
Yeah.
Ron Thomas is probably the only one.
Okay.
And maybe Don Golden is still there. But still do a great program, and they certainly make me proud to be able to say I was part of it.
Yeah. Well, terrific. I appreciate you talking to me.
Okay.